Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Podcast. I am Ted Kluck, joined as always in studio by my good friends and partners in radio, Barnabas Piper and Ronald J. Martin. Pipe, you are back fresh off the SBC convention, which was a time of refreshment and renewal and encouragement for you.
That's right. It's such a non-contentious,
absolutely
friendly, unified environment with full of people with good fashion sense and fitness.
Absolutely.
And healthy emotional lives and really, really positive views of other genders. It's wonderful. I love the whole thing.
What's crazy is that, like, just, you know, being on social media all week, I haven't seen a hair about this anywhere. Nobody's posted a thing about SBC.
No journalists there. No controversies between prominent leaders of any kind. I mean, it felt semi-miraculous.
Just business as usual.
Yeah, absolutely.
Non-contentious. It's
nothing to see here.
Been
no reason to drive three and a half hours to Atlanta every evening just to
sign
have
me up for the SBC. Sign me up.
It's my favorite event every year for all of these reasons. I just adore it so much. It's wonderful.
There it is, Barnabas Piper, positive man. And in that vein, Pipe, in the vein of positivity and things that
and
you're
men.
Excited about, and men, absolutely, and men. We have one more week with a sponsor, and I want you to give it the Michael Jordan treatment, just the full-on promo read treatment. And then Piper, I have a follow-up question. Do we have any business in the pipeline? Do we have new sponsors waiting, or are we in a bit of a lull here business-wise?
We have – the summer's a bit of a lull. We have some lined up a little bit for later in the fall, some more publishing books. But if you are a ministry or a business, or we've had individuals who want to promote something, we're happy to have those conversations with you. We will turn down the occasional sponsor if it's not a good fit, but – most of the time, we want to figure out how to make it work. So if you hit us up at happyrantpodcast@gmail.com, I'll usually respond within a month. I'm a little slow, but, you know, I'll get back to you eventually, and we'll line something up.
You know what I think it's time for, sponsor-wise?
What's that?
I'm ready to get some awesome free stuff. Like, we've done a lot of books, and I love that. I love getting money from Christian publishers, but I don't know. I would like some free stuff. So I think we need to line up that kind of
sponsorship. You know, one of my greatest sponsorship disappointments is with this podcast?
What, dude?
The leather goods company we never could get the sponsorship off the ground like 3 years ago. The craft leather
dude,
thing.
Right.
I was like, I could use a new belt or wallet or like,
dude, or
you know,
bag,
messenger
like a bag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, we need Saddleback Leather to jump on board, man. I've already paid them about $9,000 for half their product. So I'd love to get something.
Baby, I don't want you paying for leather anymore, okay?
I would love to not pay for leather anymore.
Now,
I would love to be
there,
a free recipient of leather products.
Aren't there like 4,000 of these hipster leather goods places in Nashville? Can't we like swing a cat in any direction in that town and hit some little hipster who's making leather stuff? I feel like we should be falling out of bed in the morning into like leather goods.
I feel like Nashville is more carpet. Like hemp. It's a lot of hemp and canvas because leather harms animals, you know? There's a distinct implication that an animal died to make a leather good.
Right, but we'll do canvas. Yeah. I'm not like an anti-canvas guy.
Dude, no, I'm pro-canvas. We're all pro-canvas boys. But I think we got to get a little more Texan or a little more Midwestern where they don't care about killing animals.
What do they do with all the hides of the cows from Texas Craft Steaks? Like, do they
well,
do
that's
something?
What does Chandler do? What does Chandler do after he murders all those cows and produces all of his craft steaks? Where does that leather go?
Dude, Channy needs to partner with a wafy little hipster who can use
Chandler
all
leather.
Chandler leathers. That's incredible.
I mean, he's right up the interstate from Austin. There's more hipsters in Austin than there are in Nashville, and that's saying
absolutely
something. So yeah, I feel like somebody there could turn these into like coasters and bags and belts and, you know, medallions and flat brimmed hats.
Hey, I'll tell you what, man, why can we just, okay, getting off the leather thing, but closely connected to it. Why hasn't Maddie Chan done a little promo on our show for his steak company? Maddie Chan, if you're listening, we're happy to promo your steak.
And we know you are.
I don't want us paying for steaks anymore either.
It could correct.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, at this point, we just want the whole cow processed. We want all the meat. We want all the leather.
Dude.
We want all of it. Just send it our way. That'll be our payment. The
just
whole cow is processed appropriately.
Pipe, come on, man. Promo Hall of the Mountain King, would you?
All right. Well, you know, pivoting back to the conversation about the wonderful event that I was at recently, the book is The Rise of the Servant Kings, and I can think of more than a handful of Southern Baptist men who could stand to read this book, because this is a book about servant leadership and being a humble man and the character of Christ in manhood. It's written by Ken Harrison. It is published by Waterbrook Multnomah. They're the actual sponsor, so thank you, Waterbrook Multnomah. And it's so Ken Harrison is involved in Promise Keepers, which, as we've discussed previously, still does in fact exist and has sort of morphed into more of a online community resourcing as opposed to the big stadium events of the 90s, which seems to be the way everything is going. Stadium events are going away unless your name is Joel Osteen.
We should bring basically. Back stadium events, boys.
Really?
Let's do a Happy Rant live in a stadium. Yeah.
I'm down with that. You know, we could go to the Silverdome, or did they knock
exactly.
it down?
Exactly. They knocked it down. Yeah,
bummer.
We could have done that a couple years.
Missed our window.
Yeah.
But yes, Rise of the Servant Kings is the book. What the Bible says about being a man, it's looking at the deep Christ-like character of manhood much more than sort of the seven steps to being a better man or the warrior manhood. Although there is a sword on the cover, and that's a little bit uncomfortable to me.
But is that toxic masculinity, Piper?
Well,
which yes. you would know about because you spent like 48 hours as a toxic man.
That's true. I did. I tweeted something that offended lots of people. So I'm a toxic man, clearly. Mm-hmm. But it is servant king, not warrior king, which would be an entirely different and very toxic thing. Anyway, listeners, go check this out. If you know Southern Baptist men who could use this book, send Rise of the Servant Kings to your favorite toxic man for Father's Day, although this will probably release after Father's Day. So send it to them as a late Father's Day gift. It's available now from anywhere you buy books. Check it out.
Mm. Good stuff, Pipe. Economical, too.
Which means rushed.
Yeah, which means rushed and furtive. Exactly. Boys, we've got some interesting creativity-related topics to suss out today, and I like doing this with you guys because we're, we're people who made our livings doing creative things, and these are always fun things to suss out. So I want to start with one that hits a little close to home, and I want to ask the following question: are writers ever done? Asking for a friend, actually, no, maybe just asking for myself, because I think I might be done. I think after, many, many years and X number of books, it might be over. And is that a thing that that happens to writers? Is it okay to be done? Is it okay to say, like, I don't have anything else to say, so I'm just done? What do you guys think? Or do you think, like, we should keep writing books as long as we can get deals?
I mean, I think the answer, I don't think there's an answer that's like a blanket for everybody, but I certainly think some writers finish, and I think there are a lot of writers who should finish, because I think there's a lot of people who put out books because they've sort of backed themselves into an expectation corner or a publishing contract corner, and they don't have anything to say, and they keep trying to say stuff, or they say the same thing over and over again. But then you get, like, there are some classic books, classic novels, To Kill a Mockingbird, for example, that were the only significant published work by that author. So they said what they had to say, and then they just were like, well, I'm going to move on and live the rest of my life doing something else. I think there's a weird expectation on people who write now that it sort of always be writing. Instead of recognizing that, like, writing has a scope. It's not it's not a lifestyle. It's a project. So projects have completion times and completion dates, and like stories have arcs and they're supposed to come to an end. And so at some point, the only reason to keep writing is if you have something to say and you love it. Otherwise, go do something else.
Yeah, I mean, you're not like always be mowing the lawn, even if it doesn't need it. Get out there,
there's nothing in life that you should always be doing besides like maintenance things. You should always be eating healthy or exercising or keeping your house clean or whatever. But those aren't projects. Those are like, we have to keep coming back to them to keep things up. That's not how writing works. Like, once it's said, it's said. It's a creative work. Yeah. It's done, it's not like always be editing. No, at some point you just, you hit send, you go to the publisher, you're done.
Yeah.
I think the only reason to keep writing is there's an inner sort of enjoyment compulsion, and you have something definitive to say.
Yeah, that's right. Ronald, when we were texting about this, you said you had the answer to this question. And I'm dying to hear it. Lay it on me.
Baby, I think it's like this, right? So I agree with what Pipe said, although I don't like the word project, but I actually agree with what he said.
Baby, why don't you like the word project?
Because he's an Enneagram 4. That's why. Because
it just it makes it sound dismissive, right?
Hold on. Suss that out. Because I didn't mean it as a dismissive thing, so I want to know why it sounds dismissive to you. I'll adjust my wording if that actually is a dismissive
word. You don't need to adjust your wording, Pipe. Project to me has connotations of something that is there was nothing there. We built it. We finished it. We forget about it. And I feel like writing has the ability.
But isn't that exactly how it works, though?
But you want writing to be something that like continues, that has that has like a it's not a shelf life thing. It's something that can continue to to grow and to formed in people's minds and hearts.
But the writing itself is a project. Like, you know, you got to do a book. It's whatever, 10 chapters, 40,000 words, 50,000 words, and.
Yeah, the writing itself you complete is that project.
And like for me, I forget the things that I've written. There is an element of not dismissively forget, but like there's a life moves forward and that's a thing that happened in the past.
It's
and
a so, project for the writer, maybe not for the reader.
And that's I guess that's the perspective I was coming from. I mean, I hope that things that I've written still resonate with people. I guess my first book came out 5 years ago this month. Yeah. So I hope those still resonate.
Yeah.
Even industry wise, though, the book comes out, you get like 3 weeks of hard promo and then they're immediately on to the next thing. So in that sense, it is from their standpoint, like probably the very definition of a project.
They're looking at it from a business perspective.
Yeah. So. They get done with your project and then it's on to somebody else's, you know, that hopefully will sell more copies. But nevertheless, you were on your way to answering this for me.
No, but I think writing is seasonal. I think some people write and it doesn't necessarily come from more like artistic leaning inside of them. It's a little more utilitarian. It's a little more tactile. It really depends on what you're writing. But I remember somebody told me this ages ago. Somebody told me that he said a true artist creates art. Like it's not something that he can just stop doing. It's something that's always coming out of him. It doesn't mean it's perpetually coming out of him, like every minute of every day. But yeah. I think if you're writing from the perspective of, you know, wanting to discover things or explore things because of something that's birthed in you that you then have something to say, then whether it happens like once every, you know, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, at some point, because it's something that births in you and you have to get it out of you, as a writer, you're going to continue to write. And again, that has nothing to do with whether it gets published or anybody hears it. It's almost like something that you have to do because it's something unexplored and undiscovered in you. And the way it becomes explored and discovered is by coming out of you and writing, you know, from you. And so I think with you, baby, I think at some point you might just be in a season where you just don't have anything to say. There's nothing unexplored in you. Yeah. But at some point, because I look at your writing as being a little more artistically driven, that's my opinion of it. Mm-hmm. At some point, you're going to catch some level of inspiration that's going to cause, you know, whatever births inside of you as a result of that to need to come out of you, right? Yeah. And that's really the definition of art in a lot of ways. It's like you have something that needs to be said because you want to say it, and it'll eventually come out. Just maybe not today, maybe not next year, maybe at some point down the road it will inspire again. But that would be my take on it. A true writer never stops writing. And never stops writing means they might write a bunch of things that nobody ever hears about or ever gets published.
Or there's the, you know, there's the very significant and nebulous part of the writing process, which is idea generation. And which is, I don't buy into inspiration very much, at least not the way a lot of people talk about it, because I feel like that's sort of waiting for magic to happen. And that's kind of nonsense. But
I disagree. But go on.
I disagree too, Ron.
I think inspiration is real, but it's like the thing that's it starts you moving, and then the work is what keeps it moving. I don't think inspiration drives you all the way through a writing to completion of a writing. I don't want to use the word project because I will be dismissing somebody apparently, but the completion of the writing arc, whatever that is, nonfiction book, article, whatever it is, inspiration
takes work. It takes work.
Inspiration starts you. Work finishes the project.
Yeah,
but. But anybody who thinks in the mindset of a writer or probably filmmaker or songwriter, you're sort of looking and listening all the time for ideas or stories or phrases or something that you go, that's the hook. That's the hook to whatever I need, whatever I'm going to write next.
I'll give you an example from yesterday. So I was on the phone with my college roommate, dear friend, one of my best friends. We talk frequently, and one of the things we do from time to time, not often, but every once in a while, we'll like Google people that we went to college with just to like see what they're up to. And we Googled this guy who was the consummate, like, he was that guy who was always networking, even in college. He was always dating girls with like dads who were way richer than his dad, and like going on ski trips that he couldn't afford. And he was this guy, and this guy put in like a decade in quote unquote ministry, which he would now call like the NGO or cause space. And anyway, he now has a company, and we looked at his company's website for like 20 minutes, and it was this indecipherable word salad of like 2019 business terms, like influence and relationships and you know, just all these words that used to mean different things, like scaling.
Or used to mean something.
They used to mean something, but now mean like totally different things. And so we looked at this, we kind of had a big laugh over it. And then I ended up writing about it. I wrote this like column for the paper that's like a 2019 business term translator. So what the words used to mean, what they actually mean now. You know, it was fun, but that's an example of inspiration, right? You know, definitely not enough there to like power a book or even a long article, but it was enough for 700 or 800 words.
Well, right, and like the book that I'm working on right now, the happiness book on happiness and expectations, I remember a conversation I had with a guy, and it's the only time I've ever talked to the guy. I don't even remember his name. And we were talking about work, and he said, you know, do you love your job? And I said, mm-hmm. You know, it's fine. I'm grateful for it. I appreciate my coworkers. I'm doing work that I find significant, but I'm not like jumping out of my skin excited for work.
Yeah.
And he looked at me and goes, man, you need to find a new job. You need to find something you're passionate about. And I was like, that's terrible advice.
Was this guy under the age of 25?
No, he was my age, which was more disappointing to me, because I'm like,
weird.
You are supposed to be a grown up. But also, he just sort of lives in the Nashville creative space where there's a lot of that nonsense thinking, and people who can't make a living because they're waiting for the perfect thing.
Why is that nonsense thinking so attractive?
Because happiness matters more than money to people, I think. Mm-hmm. And so they're also, and this thus the inspiration for the book, going back to inspiration, is kind of that question, like, what gets somebody to think that way? What is he hanging his hopes on? And what's a realistic expectation for the life of a 30-something dad, which he is as well.
Yeah.
And just so, yeah, that's inspiration. Like that, because that's something I can come back to perpetually and go, okay, it's that kind of question that I'm trying to address. You know, if I get bogged down in a mess of like Bible verses and ideas and where was I even going with this and why am I doing this? Oh, it's that question. And in that sense, I do believe in inspiration. I guess what I meant by inspiration is more like the emotional momentum does not carry you through to effective completion of a creative work.
Yeah. I think you're still steering too far with that comment, Pipe.
Really?
Really?
I think so. Yeah. Cause if I'm not feeling, if I have to, I keep waiting for that emotion to kind of keep driving me, or else the writing becomes too clinical and it becomes too information driven. It becomes too lectury for me. I'm not saying that happens to you, but so I'm always looking for I need that inspirational, emotional component. That's just the way I'm wired. And I need that to like, for the writing or the songwriting, I need that for it to sort of come to completion in the way that is satisfying to me. And it actually communicates what I want communicated.
See, that's interesting because I draw a distinction between inspiration and motivation. And maybe that's an utterly semantic thing to most people.
It might be. I would say it is. From the way I look at it, I would say it is. Yeah.
For me, inspiration is the starting point. Motivation is the why of the project, which sounds real closely related to what you just said, I think, because that's the thing you sort of harken back to and go, what's the purpose of this? What's the drive? Like, why am I sitting here on hour number 6 on a Saturday when I could be doing anything else? Oh, it's this. This is the purpose. And so, which motivation, inspiration, I guess I don't really, maybe there's not a distinction there, but for me, that's a motivating factor, sort of honing back in on that purpose of things that does give the, okay, we're going to keep driving. And also it breathes life into things a little bit, but that might not be at all different than what you're describing.
It might not be. I think for me, like that never changes. So from project to project, my motivation is that I want people to actually receive this particular expression, right? So it's like, it doesn't need to be more. So again, everybody's going to have a different motivation, right? So for me, I have something in me that I want to get out of me, and I want people to enjoy this particular moment of expression, you know, to get arty about it, right? And so that is always the motivator for me. It's just, I have something now that has to get out. I have an idea. I want other people to benefit, to enjoy, to receive the idea, mm-hmm. and the expression. So, I mean, it doesn't have to even be more high-minded than that for me, you know. Gotcha. They can decide how high-minded they want it to be, you know. So other people will be like dismissive of it, whatever, it was fine. Other people, I hate it. Other people, greatest thing of all time. That's why I'm okay with anybody having any opinion about it, because it's like, well okay, here it is.
Well, and I think also what comes out of this conversation is just the very distinct different ways people approach writing. I mean, probably any creative work. I don't delve deeply into other kinds, but the things that drive you are not exactly the things that drive me. Although I would bet if you did a Venn diagram, it's like an 80% overlap.
Probably is.
And then that 20% is more that motivation, inspiration, feeling, you know, connection with an audience, those things that are that are completely intangible, but are essential to the whole process and completing of the work.
And then you have to talk about, again, the way you might interpret motivation also lends itself to the fear of people receiving it, which then affects even, you know, your motivating process, right? So I want to write that, but I'm going to pull back a little bit because I'm afraid of the comments or the way it's going to be received. So, I mean, all this stuff is sort of, it's inextricably linked in some ways, right? In terms of how we go about creating, and then how we decide what we want to include and exclude and all of those types of things. It's kind of complex, really.
Do you guys think of yourselves as sort of fearful writers in terms of, like you said, sort of holding back because of how people receive it, or that sense of insecurity or imposter syndrome or something where you're writing something and do you have a great sense of nervousness about putting that out there for people or writing things in a certain way that might not land well? Or do you just have the confidence to kind of be like, no, I said what I said?
No, I'm not nervous. I think for me, like, it's not on a book to book or a piece by piece basis. For me, it's more like, do I even want to be a writer anymore, given the way things are now? So I guess it's more of a macro question of what does it mean to be a writer today versus what did it mean to be a writer 10 years ago? But if I actually decide to write something, I do it, you know, 95% without fear. You know, I think there's always that little niggling, like, how is this going to land moment. And if you don't have that, you're probably a sociopath, but yeah, I would say that once I decide to write, it mostly gets pulled off, you know, outside of fear. What about you, Ron?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a great question. I think, for me, and again, it goes back to my own internal wiring, but I think my fear would be that I'm not going to be as known as I want whatever I'm releasing to make me known as. So in other words, I want it to be understood the way I'm writing it to be understood. Right. And so, and that's more of an angst, you know, that's almost more of an irritation, you know, maybe
it's being irritated with the audience. Like they're going to misinterpret this.
They're going to misinterpret it. Yeah, and so, yeah. and then you start writing to make sure it's interpreted the right way. But then it almost takes the soul out of it a little bit. Or
sure.
Right. That's when you get into all like the nuances and caveats, instead of like making a bold claim or a statement with some teeth to it. You start filing the teeth down by being like, but also this. Well, also it could be understood this way. And then there's this perspective, and you've immediately turned it into a, you know, Gospel Coalition article, which is usually sort of really flat on a creative standpoint.
That's a great example. Yeah. I wrote this was a couple of years ago. I wrote a couple of pieces for a couple different, you know, pubs like Gospel Coalition, and I forget a couple other ones. And all of them, but it was kind of the same piece. And Gospel Coalition was like, we're not really getting a clear enough, meaning or understanding through this. And I said, well, the piece is meant to be a little ethereal in nature, right? It's supposed to be a little more emotive driven. And so I'm not looking for just, here's my 3 points at the end. And they just didn't like that. And somebody else.
It's because you use the word emotion with the Gospel Coalition.
Correct.
That's a hard no for them.
But I mean, it was another online thing like TGC, and they said the same thing. They said, we get where you're going, but we wish it was clear. And I said, well, what if the intention is for it not to be clear? But, and I'm saying all the wrong words with that, of course. And then it was somebody else that grabbed it, this other online pub that was a little more open-minded.
Like Fathom Magazine or something like that? One of those?
But they embraced it like fully. They didn't even edit it. They said, oh, we love it. We'd love you to write more stuff like this for. So it's funny that just the different, again, everybody's going to receive things differently. And it took like three offerings before one person finally said, I get exactly what you're doing here and we love it and we want to release it.
Right. And I mean, I had the same experience. I mean, we probably all have with book proposals where it goes from publisher to publisher. And I had one publisher with the current project who read it as exactly the opposite of what I was trying to say. Like, I thought I was pretty clear in the proposal, like, I'm trying to accomplish these things. And they came back and said, no, what it sounds like is you're saying this. And I was like, no, I specifically said that's not what I'm doing. So I don't know what they missed. And then others who were just like, I don't really get it. Like, okay, well, then it's not for you because I don't want to work with a publisher who doesn't get it. They also don't want to work with me, so that worked out.
Well, yeah,
okay.
then it's a mutuality then. Right. But baby, let me ask you this, man. When you talk about not wanting to write, is it more of sort of the engine of the publishing industry that tends to really make you feel like, man, you don't even want to contribute anything to that because you know what they're going to do with it?
Dude, I think that's part of it, but it's not even that angsty, right? Okay. Like it would almost be sexier if it was that angsty, because then I would be like creating my own underground thing or whatever on the side. But I think it's more just maybe it's run its course, like maybe, and it may have been sort of a similar, I guess divorce is too strong of a word, but a similar kind of reimagining of the relationship that you had with the music industry where you put out a bunch of records. And in my case, you put out a bunch of books and it's just like not as fun anymore. You know what I mean? Like the thrill is not there. And there's really like, one kind of thing that I still enjoy doing. It's writing these little graphic novels with Harvest House, which I hope I'll do a bunch more of those. But like, that's the fun thing in writing that I hope I get to keep doing. And really all the other stuff, like I have no desire to ever write a nonfiction book proposal anymore and go, oh, I hope this really makes it. I hope they get it, and maybe that'll come back, I hope it'll come back. But as of right now.
Well, I would say that you're answering your own question, though, because in that sense, you are writing. You've just discovered a new channel of writing that is enjoyable. So that's what you're pursuing right now. It's not any more valid or invalid than anything else you've done. It's just
a
particular groove right now. And you like being in it. Stay in it for a while.
Yeah, man. Hopefully.
Yeah.
So along those lines, boys, I think one of the things that writers use to prop themselves up, right? I mean, there's all these little emotional coping mechanisms that writers use, but one of them is calling themselves artists and thinking of themselves as artists. Is there a difference between being a writer and an artist, or are writers like inherently artists? And are you comfortable with that term? I'm not comfortable with it. I think that's more of a function of growing up in Indiana than maybe anything real or not real about it, but like calling yourself an artist just seems like unbelievably pretentious and fey in a way that I'm not comfortable with. But what do you guys think about this? Are writers artists, or is there a distinction?
I don't know. The distinction I make is that, no, I don't think all writers are artists. I think writing, like songwriting and some of these painting, I think it's an artistic expression. So it's creating something out of nothing in some ways. I know you can break that down as well. Yeah. But I think it's creating something from scratch that you want other people to enjoy and listen to or look at. And it doesn't mean that every artistic expression, I think, lands as sort of an equal sort of, how we might define something to be considered art or not, certainly it can be one person's art could be another person's, non-art. Right. So I think there's too many ways to break it down. I do think it's an artistic expression in that it's making something, it's creating something out of nothing. However it lands, I mean, you're going to see greater expressions, more original expressions of that art that's going to create something that's going to be far more inspirational to many other people, that's going to cause them then to want to be, you know, to express themselves in those same ways. But I think there's too many nuances in it. And I think, I think this idea of wanting to be, you know, perceived as an artist, instead of just, you know, getting down to the thing that you want to express is probably less important, you know, in the end.
Yeah. I think this would agree with what Ronnie's saying, but writing is use of a resource. It's use of vocabulary to communicate something. But so like painting is use of paint to do a task. Or, you know, so like painting, you can paint a wall that's very utilitarian and a very good use of paint. You know, you turn an ugly wall into a pleasant wall. But that's not artistic. That's just utilitarian. You can paint a sign. That maybe can have some artistic elements if you do it with some style. But again, it's really just more craftsmanship than it is artistry. Or you can be like, you know, Monet, and all of a sudden, oh, that's definitively art. That's a creative thing that's doing something new, that's eliciting feeling. There's an expression there. And not all – some writing is simply a communication of information. There's nothing artistic about that. It doesn't make it bad writing. It just means it serves its purpose, and its purpose is to communicate something. I think anything that can be called art has to elicit feeling or to move somebody in a non – kind of – a non-articulated way, in, you know, so it makes you feel a thing that you didn't feel previously. And so you can be an informational writer who there's some of that in there. There's sort of a sweeping element to it. But most writing is much more explanatory, inspirational, kind of thing. And when I say inspirational, it's more like a coach is inspirational, not like art is inspirational. It's like, get out there and do this thing. Mm-hmm. Very little writing is like you just sit back and go, wow, that moved me for how it was written.
Yeah.
Not just probably what it said, but how it was said.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You can probably count on one hand the number of authors that make you feel that way.
And I think that how it was said aspect is the difference between artful writing and not artful writing. And so the vast majority of people who call themselves artists are not. They're coaches. They're teachers. Their writing is doing a lot of different things, but it's not making people cry because the sentence was beautiful. Yeah. And that's like, I mean, that's an extreme, but that's artistic.
The word has been bastardized in the way that so many words have in our culture. I mean, like in 2019, calling yourself a storyteller means you work in advertising, you know, and it used to mean that you wrote novels or screenplays, and now it means you're like you're an ad guy, you know. Oh, I'm telling your company's story. I'm a storyteller.
Yeah, or you like filming commercials, like, oh yes, I'm a storyteller via film. Nope, that's a commercial.
You're just
selling stuff.
It's weird, man. Everything is everything
is
different.
People have because creativity is much broader than artistry. And people so people want to be an artist because that feels – well, A, it feels undefined, and people love that, especially you Enneagram 4 types. And it also nobody can pin you down. It's just it's very – and it feels elite. But if you do creative work, you can write creative ad copy. You can write a creatively crafted sermon, although I would say don't try too hard to do that because you'll probably – just get
suck
off track.
At it.
Yeah, and suck at it. But you can write a creatively crafted nonfiction Christian book, and that's okay. It doesn't have to be artful. I think artistry is a gift. Creativity, I think there's a gift element. There's also I can get better at this element, and it's a
right.
And just not all of us are artists. I don't know if I am. I think I hope that periodically I write a sentence or a paragraph that has those elements in it. But my goal is to be a really good craftsman and a creative expressor of things, and maybe that tips into artistry. But I don't think I'm an artist. And I think most people who call themselves artists would be more accurate if they said, I try to do creative work.
Yeah. I think that's true. Ronald, any additional thoughts on that?
Yeah, I like it. I mean, I it might be a little too nuanced for me, but I don't disagree with anything Pipe said. You know, I think there's a lot of truth in that. And, you know, I think just the available mediums now that we have in terms of like doing something creative, having, you know, our social networks see or hear what we do, it's kind of perpetuated the myth of, you know, everybody's an artist, everybody's a creative type. And, you know, there was a time when to even get your material out into the marketplace or in view of people, that in and of itself was part of the creative process, right? It was, man, how do I do this? How do I get, you know, where do I find my first break? And how do I meet the right people? And how do I, you know, how do I maneuver this in a way that people are actually going to hear my expression? So, man, I think just the availability of getting things out there, whatever that means, has just sort of cheapened the medium as a whole a little bit. Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of people that write a lot about that now because just the availability of everything. And sure. So that's kind of made everything very non-exclusive. And to me, art had, you know, when you look back, there was more of an exclusivity about, you know, hey, part of the way this person got even discovered and founded, you know, for the art that they create was this process. And that's even part of the story of how their, you know, art came into being. And so, again, all of that has been lost in some ways. And so we've kind of cheapened it, which I think goes back to a lot of what Pipe was saying for sure. You know,
just baby, I think I missed that exclusivity. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think for sure.
Certain things used to be special. You know,
I was thinking about that when you were talking about sort of the, like, I don't even know if I should keep doing this and resonating with it a little bit. You know, there even just thinking about something as mechanical as web traffic, you know, 7-10 years ago, if you wrote online, so whether it was an article or you were a blogger or whatever, there was just you knew you could get traffic if you could do a decent job.
Yeah.
And so there was a period of time where if somebody's like, how do I get started as a writer? The most natural thing to say was go start writing online, like start a blog, something. That's a complete waste of time now. It's not a complete waste of time from a practice standpoint, like,
sure,
you know, getting your reps in, but nobody's going to see it unless it's very, very hard to get noticed. And I think that is probably the most discouraging aspect of writing right now is you do the best you can, you hope it's good work, and you go, how do I even get this in front of people? And somebody like the three of us, we probably have more accessibility to get in front of people because we have podcasts or social media platforms, not you, Ted, or you know, just the connections we have having done this for a while, and it's still discouraging.
Totally. Like
I'm already tired of marketing a book that I haven't even written yet.
Exactly.
Because I'm like, what are ways that I can do that without just being part of the cacophony of noise saying, read my stuff, read my stuff, read my stuff.
Oh, I know.
I don't know how to do that.
Too much stuff. I mean, I was talking to the VP of, and there's a reason for this, so it's not going to sound how it does, but the VP of New Growth Press. Have you heard of that publisher?
Yeah.
Never heard of them, baby.
Okay.
Yeah, they do a lot of like a lot of the counseling books associated with like CCEF and stuff. Paul Tripp used to publish with them a lot.
Good stuff. But anyway, she said, she made this comment because I'm not a stats guy, but she said, if you go back 20 years ago, she said to today, she said, there are four times as many books written, the same amount of books are being sold as that were being sold years ago. And so she said
that's not exactly
20 years, dude.
More books are being sold now. I think that's an incorrect statistic. Maybe they have flat sales, but by like industry wide, there are more books being sold, but not four times as many.
Well, again, those stats are never literal in my mind, but nevertheless, it was still, you know, it's still the same. Like it's not four times as many. Because there's that much more product, it doesn't mean that product's all being sold either.
Yeah.
And I think it just kind of shows more of the glut, you know?
Yeah, dude, I get it. Like, I don't know, and I'm not looking for a specific number here, but like, how many of your friends have book deals? Like, all my friends have book deals. And I'm not friends with writers. You know, I'm just friends with who I want to be friends with. And now, like, 15 years later, they all got book deals. Like, my thing isn't even special anymore. You know, and it's one of those things that I think points to, well, maybe I'm drawn to a certain kind of person, and the kind of person I'm drawn to,
there's something to be said for that, because and I'm gonna risk sounding just grotesquely egotistical, but I think we would all agree.
I just did, so join the club.
So if you're somebody who's good at writing, And I think all three of us would look like we would look at our work and say, yeah, I'm better at this than most people. Mm-hmm. And that's I think that's simply an objective statement. I don't think that's I don't think I'm a better person than they are. I have any more value, but my work is better than their work. Mm-hmm. That's a really frustrating thing when you see people getting book deals who can't write or who are writing dumb stuff that's already been written or redundant stuff, or it's the schlock that sells, but there's no craftsmanship in it whatsoever. That is really frustrating to me. Yeah. And, you know, I've worked in publishing for close to 15 years, and it's just wash, rinse, repeat on that front. And that's an aggravating aspect, and it can be very demotivating because, you know, you said all your friends have book deals. Yeah, I know half a dozen people who have book deals, and I'm like, no, I don't want to read your blog. I barely want to read your tweets. And yet you have a book deal because publishers are caught up in the manic cycle of this too. It's a market-driven thing much more than a filter-driven thing in terms of
– For sure.
No publisher has the leeway to stop and say, nope, we're only going to publish the books we believe in.
Oh, yeah, so, and it's a who you know it too. I mean, all these industries are there's a high who you know.
Yeah, totally. And to be clear, I mean, I think my friends can write, but maybe this is the ultimate Enneagram 4 thing where it's like, okay, everybody's doing my thing now. I have to find a new thing.
It's not a special. Yeah, it loses its a speciality. Yeah.
Dude, that could be it. That could honestly be it.
Yeah.
You know, and who knows what the next thing will be.
That's a whole other conversation though, isn't it? Like,
it really
is. I would like it more if less people were doing it because it would make what I'm doing a little
more special. Yeah, absolutely, dude. That makes us the worst. We sound like terrible people.
We sound like artists.
Well, you're just,
yeah, we do, man.
You're just going to back yourself into a corner or into isolation. You will probably end up exceptionally frustrated because the means of doing anything creative today have like the bar has lowered so much and the accessibility has increased so much. Anybody can be a videographer. Anybody can be a visual artist. And I don't mean that they can be good at it. I just mean they can do it, we've seen with writing. So like, there's nothing special anymore. The only way to be special is to do better work than other people.
Yeah. And that's nothing ever changes.
But then you can't stand out because there's a billion books.
Right. It doesn't guarantee an audience.
Right.
You know, well,
but that's always been the case. There are books right now that none of us have ever heard of that if we could go back 100 years and find it, something that was published by some publishing company that sold 9 copies and we picked it up and we would say, this is the greatest thing I've ever read. And 9 people read it. You know, I mean, that's always the case. That is always going to exist. So in that way, in that sense, you know, the best art, the best creative, the best creativity doesn't always rise to the top either. You know, you have to do it because you want to do it at the end of the day, regardless of who receives it, who hears it, who reads it. So it kind of goes back to the artist or the creative person at the end of the day. Do you want to do it because you want to do it?
All right, baby. One last question. And this is going to hit close to home. I just introduced my son, my oldest son, to the wonderful world of the John Wick movies. So we watched John Wick 1 and 2, and then we capped
it
off.
That's because you're a good dad.
Well, I think I'm a terrible dad.
But you're great, T. You're the greatest dad of all time.
We capped off the experience by checking out John Wick 3 in the theater. So my question to you, Ronald, is are the John Wick movies art? If you're the screenwriter, are you calling yourself an artist?
I mean, dude, those kind of movies are my least favorite movies in the world. But let me just say this, Big M, my wife, likes those kind of movies. That's how we're different and what makes me even more special. But she wanted to see John Wick 3. We watched it. Mm-hmm. When we got to the 9th scene and the 19th scene and the 90th scene, which was the same fight scene as the first scene, which is why I don't like movies like that. They're all the same. You know, I got to admit, I at one point like just sat back and I thought, man, like there is an art to this, isn't there? The way they're like filming it and the way they had to choreograph it. And so, I think they're already.
I think they're already too. Here's where I think the artistry comes in the John Wick movies, the interior spaces. Like all three of those movies
element of it.
Like the bars, the hotel rooms, they have the most satisfying interior spaces, I think, of any movie franchise in recent memory.
It's like not my art of choice, but that just because it's not my art of choice doesn't make it less arty. I mean, we all have our preferences with art, but I can recognize it as art.
Yeah. If I could nerd out a little bit, I love the John Wick movies. I haven't seen John Wick 3 yet because I had to rewatch 1 and 2 just to make sure I was up to speed and kind of filled in. The thing that stood out to me is there's a ton of kind of artistic elements in their world building, their storytelling. Oh, yeah. Because most action movies are simply built around action. And certainly John Wick is mostly built around him just destroying people. But you've got the Continental Hotel, you've got these ones in different continents.
Countries,
you've got there's like different levels and roles and how all this thing fits together. And it feels very intricate. And the whole thing makes you go, I want to know the backstory to this. Like when you watch the Fast and the Furious movies, you go, you don't want to watch, you're here for the explosions and the car races and whatever. There's no backstory. You don't care. Or they ham-handedly tell you the backstory and they're like, well, when I was in prison, you know, and John Wick does an entirely different thing. It feels like there's a lot of story that's untold, but they've told you enough that you get it, but you're also like, but what else? And that's a whole different kind of thing.
What's fascinating about that is I always reread reviews after I watch something, and the reviews I've read on John Wick 3, it's funny you say that, Pipe, because what they're saying is all those things you said about John Wick, the third one has not gotten great reviews. They've said, no, it lacked sort of that world-building quality and element that the first two had. It was too much action. It just was kind of all like – just
well, dude, yeah, seemed to me, it seemed like a placeholder before John Wick 4. Kind of like how with prestige TV nowadays, like, and I noticed this with Mad Men way back in the day, but also with some other shows, like you'll get an episode that's just a banger, and then you'll have kind of a placeholder, and then you'll have another banger, and it's sort of like this one felt like the placeholder to me.
Isn't that sort of the nature of artistic work? Like, no artist does a masterpiece every time. There's a lot of we know the masterpieces because they hang in museums or they are bestsellers or whatever. But then there's all the other stuff that's like those are filed away in an archive under like other papers or, they were sold at some subpar gallery for, pennies somewhere. And nobody doing creative work is always at peak performance.
It's the Bridezilla of Christ of our career, baby. Bridezilla was our John Wick 3,
as opposed to the other two.
How many listeners are absolutely rolling their eyes that we are bringing a conversation? We're bringing John Wick into a meaningful conversation about art.
You know what? It works, man. The analogy works, and doggone it, I'm sticking by it. I think Keanu Reeves is an artist too. I've never liked Keanu Reeves more than in the John Wick movies.
That is 100% true.
He was a nice guy.
The Matrix was kind of his previous peak, but I think the John Wick movies are a better Keanu performance.
Oh, 100%. Can we end this podcast?
Yeah. Are you bored, baby, or you just got to go?
No, I just got to go.
Because I'm having fun. Good, good.
I'm not having a great time.
No. I wanted you to be having fun, too.
Usually that's a Ted request because Ted's like, and I don't care anymore.
No, I actually cared about this. I love this. We got to have more like this. I dug it.
Dude, me too. This has been good. This has been really good. So what I'm going to do is say that we have wandered to and fro, as we often do throughout these topics. And until next time.
The Happy Rant is brought to you by Resonate Recordings. If you go to resonaterecordings.com, you can see the full range of services they offer. So if you're considering starting a podcast, they are the ones we recommend going with. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see their prices, to connect with them and ask any questions, and to see what they can do to help you launch, edit, master, and improve your podcast. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see what they can do to help you launch and improve your podcast.
In a recent survey, parents reported that 52% of homeschooled children need learning accommodations. These parents need practical advice, encouragement, and hope to fuel their homeschooling efforts. The Empowering Homeschool Conversations podcast is where parents gain wisdom on how to teach unique learners successfully at home, like Laura, who recently told us, "I needed this episode. I don't need a fancy curriculum or need to be a special ed teacher to teach my son. You have given me hope." To listen now, go to Life Audio or search Empowering Homeschool Conversations on your favorite podcast app.